Hey listeners, just wanted to give a content warning. In this episode, we discuss physical abuse and emotional abuse. Hello, and welcome to JK's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical. I'm Jessie.
And I'm Kelly.
And in this week's episode, we're talking about A Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue by Mackenzie Lee, which tells the story of Monty, who is leaving his terrible father to go on a tour of Europe with his sister Felicity and his best friend slash crush Percy. Everything goes to shit, they join up with fake pirates, and Monty makes a fool of himself in an attempt to cure Percy of his epilepsy. I think that covers all the big things.
Nice work. What's your initial reaction for the book?
This book has been on my TBR for a long time. I have to admit that I thought it would be a lot more fantasy since it's been on a bunch of fantasy lists, but I loved it all the same. Monty had me laughing out loud, Felicity is super smart, and Percy was just generally wonderful. I loved it all.
I would describe this book as delightful. From page one, I was laughing. I really connected with Monty's voice. I didn't give a fuck about how tropey the book was or that I could see some of the twists coming because it was just so damn fun to read.
I really enjoyed it. Time to talk about all things world building in Through the Wardrobe. There was less world building in the traditional sense of what we think of because the book is set within the confines of the real world and real possible events. But I love seeing the different places because I've never been to Europe. And the people as our trio traveled around. It was pretty cool.
That was cool. I agree that the book didn't have to do as much typical fantasy world building because it's based in the real world.
Yeah. There were some things I had to like look up because I didn't know what it meant. Or like they were saying words that I was unfamiliar with. But I think it was just time period based.
In that way, I think that the style, like the lexicon that the author used was very much tied into the world building because she used words that we don't typically use now, so it was replicating the voice of 18th century England or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I liked it.
I just finished watching the show Outlander, based on the fantasy books, and it's set in the 1740s. So I was kind of relying on the images from the show to kind of populate my imaginings of the world, because they're in Britain or the UK, and they're also in France at some point, and then they are also sailing around. So I was using that kind of helped me imagine what the world was going to look like. And then I've also been to a lot of the places mentioned in the book. I've been to London, Paris, Barcelona, Venice. So it was fun to read about them, but everything set in a vastly different time period. I yelled Catalan out loud when I first read Pascal's when he starts talking in Catalan, and I was so surprised to find it's my absolute favorite language, and I had never seen it in a regular like Anglophone book before, let alone a YA fantasy book. And Catalan is so beautiful, and Barcelona is one of my favorite places in the world, so I was just so happy that Catalan language and culture was included.
I thought of you when I read it.
Did you?
Yeah, because that club that is at CU Boulder, and they like bringing in bookmarks to the library, and I was like, oh, Kelly knows what this is.
I do indeed.
Wands out.
This is the segment where we discuss all things magic.
There was not a lot of magic in this book. The magical parts were focused on alchemy, which is like science magic, kind of.
Yeah, I would say that's true. The novel really brought me back to thinking about the connections between magic and science. And lots of these connections hinge upon what's the horizon of scientific possibility in these different points throughout history, basically. And the panacea that Mateo Roblas is supposedly succeeded in creating is an alchemical cure-all like the mythical philosopher's stone. So right there you see the line basically all the way blurred between science and magic. And much of modern medicine and technology, I would say, would be considered magical from an 18th century perspective.
Yeah, it definitely would. It doesn't seem like something they would, because they don't have access to it at that time, being able to cure someone of, you know, the flu probably seems seems pretty outlandish and magical.
Right.
And I guess we see, like, not in this time period probably, but earlier, like, midwives and, like, quote-unquote witches who probably were just healers. Some of their things were seen as magical, even though they're, we would see them as, like, modern-day medicine right now, mm-hmm. or natural medicine now.
So I think when science can't catch up to it, or, like, when science that has inserted itself in the popular lexicon and popular imaginary isn't caught up with what other healers are doing,
right,
then accusations of witchcraft come along.
Yeah. I guess we get a little bit of magic in the two women. I don't remember what their names are, that we meet in France, and they are, like, doing tarot cards.
Oh, the grandmothers, the mm-hmm. Ernesta, and I forget the other one's name.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought that was cool. I was, like, looking up the tarot cards that they mentioned and stuff, and I was like, oh, this is really cool.
That's true. I really enjoyed the tarot reading part where I was like, oh yeah, King of Cups. Yeah. Oh yeah, King of Wands. Like, but King of Cups reversed. And I don't know. I don't really go with the, like, there's cards to be scared about or interpretations right. to be scared about, but it was interesting to see that that was included. I was really happy about that.
Wands away. Now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus evil in our segment, Get Me Kylo Ren. So I want to start about talking about Monty's dad, whose name I don't remember. I don't know if he, does Henry. He have a name? Is he Henry?
He's Henry Montague.
Ooh.
Or Henri.
Yeah. He is absolutely the worst. As a parent, your one job is to love and protect your child, and Monty's father is both physically and emotionally abusing him. The depictions of abuse and the emotional toll we saw them taking on Monty throughout the story were really difficult for me to read, and it, like, kept, I, like, read it one night before I went to sleep, and it, like, kept me up, like, feeling anxious that night, and it was just a lot, and I was, like, not prepared for it, I don't think. But yeah, his dad is, I don't know if his dad's supposed to be, like, the main villain of this book because we have, like, that Duke Bourbon or whatever. But for me, his dad was, like, the biggest villain.
I would agree with that. And it was almost, it was also, like, a slow reveal. Like, we were getting to know Monty. And then as the story was going on, we get more and more information revealed about the extent of what his abuse was like. And how, what the toll it had taken on him, like you said. But it's kind of like a slow burn. You don't start off knowing exactly what's happening. It starts off with hints, and then you get more and more revelations about the severity of it. And the consequences of that violence, we see them through Monty's perspective, because that's what the book's written from, right? So those were, for me, the most powerful and heart-wrenching parts of the novel. Particularly this juxtaposition between the flippant tone and dark jokes that Monty uses to talk about what actually happened, like that, like actual scenes of abuse, and then coupled with Monty's deeper reflections, then more sincere reflections that we don't get a lot of access to, about how Monty devalues himself or doesn't value himself based on having taken all of his dad's shit for so long. And just integrated it into his being and how he feels about himself, like almost that he deserves it. That really hit home for me with the book and the way it explores how it's almost internalized. It's not justifying the violence, but it's Monty doesn't stick up for himself, quote unquote, like in scare quotes, right? But that's because maybe he learned that there wasn't anything to stick up for. That's what right. he says. And that's just, oh, that was so heart-wrenching. It's so hard to read for me.
Yeah. And you can kind of see like where he almost feels like he deserves it because he doesn't value himself. And he kind of thinks like, well, I am doing this bad thing, which is like not a bad thing. And he like, it's almost like he feels like it's like deserved. And we kind of see like how that turns into like these physical responses, like when someone like raises a hand to him even though they're like not going to hit him or hurt him, and that was like very difficult to read, but also just really sad, you know,
and very real.
Yeah I think so for sure. One of the things I really liked about the book and how they dealt with this is that you can see Monty is someone who's not going to continue that cycle of abuse. Like, he doesn't have any of those, like, I don't know, like, we see the actions of his father, and we don't actively see Monty trying to distance himself from them, I don't think, but we do see that he is not a violent person in any way, shape, or form, and it seemed like to me that, like, going forward, he would not, if he had a child, or even, like, with his partner, be physically abusive or emotionally abusive to them, and I really like that, because we don't always get that in books, usually we see that cycle carry through and like continuing on. So I thought that was good.
I agree with you partially. I would say that I think he's a violent person in the sense that he redirects what he's been getting from his father onto himself.
Oh, right.
So like he's not going to replicate it onto another person, mm-hmm. or I don't feel like that's a suggestion that comes up in the novel, but that all the things he's doing to himself are very much because he has internalized this sort of logic.
Yeah. Which I'm guessing is pretty normal that you would internalize those things.
Right. All the shame and the guilt and the, you know, drink, the excess, substance abuse.
Yeah. All gambling. All of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All that risky behavior. The book dealt with that very responsibly, I would say.
I agree.
I know that the Duke of Bourbon's supposed to be a villain and he like sucks, but I agree with you that Monty's dad is the core villain in the story. The Duke of Bourbon is more there just to like keep the narrative moving, I would say.
Him and Helena probably as well. She's kind of villainous in that she also moves the story forward in that she helps the Duke find them. And obviously she's trying to kill her mom to get her dad out of jail. Just kind of weird.
Kill her already dead,
undead, but mom. Not dead mom. Yeah, she's basically like a zombie mom.
Yeah, like a vampire mom that hasn't woken up. I don't know.
Yeah, and I don't know that she can be woken up. I have no idea.
There wasn't a lot of info.
No,
not a lot of. That was a little fuzzy.
But maybe that wasn't like the important part, so it's fine.
Yeah, fair point. We interrupt these deep cuts to bring you Show Us Your Fix. Which character do you think deserves their own storyline? Let us know by finding us on Twitter or Instagram at JKMagicPod.
This isn't a ship exactly, although it would take place on a ship. I want to know more about the pirates. I really love them, and I am not a huge... I don't read pirate stories, but I just really liked that dynamic between them, and they're like... democratic pirates who aren't really hurting anyone or taking anyone for ransom. I was just like, yeah, this is cool. Can we get a black pirate story? Like, I'd like that.
I wonder if in the sequel it goes into that because it's called the A Lady's Guide to Petticoats and Piracy.
Oh, that's true. Maybe Felicity does go with them.
Because they do offer that to her at the end of the novel.
Yeah, I think I read the description of the next book and it's about Felicity joining with these women who are trying to learn medicine. So maybe she goes to learn it so that she can go be with the pirates. I like that.
Or that she's with the pirates at the beginning. I don't know. I agree. More pirates.
Just all the pirates. And yeah, we're going to get Felicity in another book. So I'm really happy for that.
I wish we would have had some of Percy's perspective. That would be cool to get some fix about that.
Yeah.
Just to see. He was clearly pining the entire time also while Monty was pining.
Right. But it was also super obvious. I'm like, Monty, you are so dumb. Like, don't you see what's going on like right in front of you? Yeah,
whatever. Exasperating.
Yeah. Okay, back to the deep cuts. Because just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender, and ability and illness. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate.
We're going to start with race, because it plays a really big role in the narrative.
Percy is biracial.
Is this the first biracial character we've read for the podcast?
I think in Ship It.
I thought Tess was not biracial. She's just black.
I don't know. Maybe I just made her biracial in my mind because I'm biracial. I'm like, let me put this on her.
Good for you. You do you.
But I was really excited because I'm biracial. And I was like, this is exciting. I get a me perspective. I get to see me in a book. I was excited.
I thought it was interesting how they handled the biracial, but he was still called... like Negro.
Oh yeah,
because it gets to the point that like unless you pass for white,
you're not white.
Yeah. So you're singled out.
Yeah,
regardless.
For
there's
sure.
No distinction. It's not like the people in 18th century England were making a distinction between him being biracial. Like,
no,
that didn't matter to them.
No. And it's almost like the one drop rule. Like if you're a little bit black, you're just black. Like it doesn't matter how much you are. I mean, if you're white passing, like please don't like pretend like you suffer all the same injustices or whatever. But yeah, I don't know.
But I thought that the narrative handled that very like realistically,
yeah.
Right? That would have been the experience of a person of color in that situation. Like it didn't matter that they were raised entirely.
Right.
They're not culturally POC.
Right, exactly. Which was interesting because Percy points out that his cause is not the cause of all black people, and how those like aren't the same thing. Like, just because he's black doesn't mean that he has like to stick up for other black people. And some of those things I was like, this is, I think these are a symptom of growing up around so many white people, because he's like, he doesn't, it's hard because he doesn't have like the privilege to push back about some of the things people are saying to him about other black people. But at the same time, he does have some privilege in that he is upper class and half white, not passing, but he's light skinned.
Educated, yeah, access to wealth.
Exactly. But he's also not like pushing for any like reforms or to help other darker black people. And that was, for me, was very realistic, but also like, Percy, you could be doing a lot better. Like, you're not really helping out like your fellow black people.
I would say a crucial part of Monty, the main protagonist's character development, is him learning about race and privilege, because he seems to take this colorblind stance with Percy in their personal relationship.
Not okay.
But it's obvious that Monty does see color because, A, he inflicts like overt racial microaggressions, if not like macroaggressions, mm-hmm. on Percy. And he also notices other times, sometimes, being important, sometimes he notices when Percy is being discriminated against or experiencing a micro or macroaggression from outside.
Right.
And Monty, I would say, is not an ally or an accomplice in any sense of the word, but he does gradually come to learn about his privilege as a white person. I think we see him starting down this process. We don't see him like, I mean, there is no end to learning about that and right. doing the work. But we see him starting to develop this like seed of consciousness of whiteness and what right. it means to have that sort of racial privilege in a society that at this time was even more like oppressive and segregated than we have now. But he starts paying attention, for example, to the racial dynamics to which he would have been completely oblivious before. And you picked this quote on page 406.
Do you want to read it? Yeah. It says, "This must be the first time in his life he's been around men who look like him, men who don't assume he's worth less because of the color of his skin." Yeah. And
I don't think that's something that Monty would have been paying attention to before had he not been called in, essentially, and overtly called out.
Right.
Because we do see a significant amount of white saviorism mm-hmm. on Monty's part, particularly in the pirate scenario.
Right.
When he's like, why aren't they thanking me for right. saving them from the French Navy?
Or when like Percy is having that interaction with that woman in France and Monty just gets mean. Like he's saying mean things instead of actually being like, no, these aren't the appropriate, like this isn't okay to say. He just like starts making fun of people instead of actually being like, what's going on here is not okay.
Which just seems very typical of this particular character, right? To use humor to mm-hmm. deflect rather than actually being like, no.
I really liked seeing how Monty kind of like came around. And I think maybe we see it a little bit when they're in Venice and he is saying how difficult it would be for him and Percy to run away together. And I think part of that is that they're two men who want to be together. But I'm guessing part of it is also that Percy is different from him in that they're different color. And that will also add another dynamic to like their relationship that would be difficult for them to just run away and go somewhere.
Right. And Percy does say at one point, like, do you think I enjoy being mistaken for your manservant?
Right.
Which is like code for slave. And I mean, that would be a good cover story, as mm-hmm. like shitty as that sounds.
Right.
But if they were to try and be together. But at the same time, the fact that like Monty wasn't even catching on to that the entire time, and they'd grown up together and they'd never really had discussions about race. That's just, I mean, race is at work, regardless of if you have an intimate relationship with someone.
Right. Yeah, I found it really interesting. And the book's written by a white woman. I'm going to guess maybe she had a bunch of sensitivity readers, because I think she did a good job showing this from Monty's perspective as a white person and showing how a person of color might deal with having a friend who is not seeing them as a person of color. Like, Monty seems to be like, well, I don't see you as black, so that should be good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, I just see you as a person. Like, we're one race, the human race, like that kind of bullshit. So I think she did a good job like navigating something that I think could be pretty difficult.
Absolutely. And laying out for the reader explicit examples of white fragility.
Right. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because that's what you were saying, like Monty redirecting and using humor. It's like taking race off the table again, right. Not talking about it, not even like refusing to engage completely. Or at one point when he was on the Monty, when they're all on the ship and the one of the sailors, I think they call him King George, was mm-hmm. asking if Percy had the same upbringing as Monty.
Right.
And Monty was like, oh, they were, you know, all in all very decent to him, except I don't think that he could have dinner with them when they had guests over. And so then King George is like, okay, so it wasn't the same
right,
at all.
Right, exactly. Not at all. And I think they also did a good job because Felicity also seems to notice that there's like this barrier between like what is going on and what Monty understands, and that Percy is not trying, like Percy's also not trying to like break that down for Monty, which is fine. Not his job to do the work for him. Nope. But Felicity is just kind of like, leave it alone. He's never going to get it. I'm like, Felicity, maybe you should explain it to him.
Exactly. I mean, that's your like, ugh. Yeah, that's so frustrating because you can tell that she understands the racial dynamics right. more than her brother does, and yet doesn't take it upon herself to like do any sort of educational work.
Right. And I guess it's kind of hard because we do see like they don't have a close sibling relationship at all. And they get closer throughout the book, which I also really enjoyed. But she's also not like doing any of the work that maybe would be helpful for Percy. And I'm guessing she spent a lot of time around him as well, if they've all grown up together.
And it's just frustrating that it's work that white people can get away with not doing, right. especially when their intimate partner is a black indigenous person of color.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
That it's not a prerequisite for dating POC.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it should be. It would help us a lot. Let's talk about class.
So many class dynamics going on. They're everywhere.
There were a ton. And so we probably will not even hit on all of them. But we kind of see in this the pressure of living in a higher class for the children. Like there is a lot of responsibility on Monty and Felicity to be a certain way because of the class they come from. So Felicity is hiding her medical books in romance novels. And I was like, at first I was like, this is so cool. She's reading romance novels. No one's giving her shit about it. Like, this is awesome. And then I realized she's hiding like schoolwork in them. And I was like, this is some bullshit.
That was so funny because I also wrote down when I was reading the book that, oh, this is the first time I see this character and she's reading smut. Like, I like her already.
And she's not, which was also a little disappointing.
I know.
Because I'm like, read smut if you want to read smut, it's fine. But you shouldn't have to hide that you want to be a doctor inside of your romance novels.
Because we get the perspective, Monty's perspective, and he's so privileged in so many different mm-hmm. ways, particularly like with class. I think that we get this like this closer view into how much the behavior is policed based on class and race and gender and all those different ways. There's so many codes of conduct that are explicitly talked about but also implicitly acted.
Yeah. And we see in the author's note at the end where she's talking about how the interactions between POCs and white people were different in the lower classes, and then the higher you got up, the more separate they were supposed to be. And I think we see that dynamic here where Percy is going to get sent away to an asylum and Monty's trying to figure out like how can he get him to stay with him but also keep his like high class standing. I thought that was interesting like thing for them to like navigate
and very realistic. I imagine someone like a character in that position wouldn't even think that giving up his privilege is like on the table, which it isn't.
Initially he's like, no, I can't do that. Like, that's not something I can do. Like, how are we going to live? It's like, figure it out.
Yeah, there's a sense that Monty realizes how much he has to lose by making the decision to stay with Percy.
Yeah, and that decision isn't just based on his race, but also that they're from different classes.
Right, especially because Monty was operating on the, we'll give you the panacea cure-all, and then we'll go back, and I'll inherit. And it's like, well, you couldn't be openly, like, bi or partnered with a man if you go back. Like, what do you expect Percy to do then? I think that the novel did a really good job of making me empathize with Monty, but at the same time be super exasperated about how close-minded and selfish he is.
Yeah, he's just not paying attention. He has no idea what's going on in the wider world.
He's so charming and likable and at the same time so annoying.
Yeah, let's talk about gender. Negative connotation associated with being a spinster. That is the case then and now. And we see Felicity already trying to disregard that in the story. And I really liked seeing her kind of, she doesn't seem to want what is like expected of her. And I really enjoyed seeing that, but I hate this negative connotation like associated with deciding not to be with a man. Like a woman's decision not to be with a man is like the worst thing they can do. It was really frustrating.
Yeah, it's almost construed as the, like a betrayal of some sort of primordial impulse, or it's portrayed as unnatural.
Yeah,
I would say, and as deviant.
Yes.
In reality, like, great, good for you.
Yeah, you don't need someone else, man or otherwise, to make you a happy, fulfilled person. At least I don't think so. And if you don't want that, then let people live their lives.
Exactly. And what's frustrating is that these sort of unpartnered people have always been around. Mm-hmm. And as like, if you're a bachelor, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
But if you're a spinster, then it's looked down upon.
Right. Exactly. And I don't know why. You can get so much stuff done if you don't have another person around bothering you.
So productive.
So I'm just like, let Felicity live her life. If she doesn't want to be with someone, then she shouldn't have to. And on that note, if she wants to be a doctor, let her become a doctor. Like, what is this bullshit about, like, women can't have professions? Like, she's supposed to stay at home and have kids. And she's upper class, so, and then have someone else take care of her kids. What do you even fill your time with?
Womanly things, quote unquote. Like, sewing? She does sew. It's just skin.
Yeah. It really comes in handy.
It really does. The book, I think, did a really good job portraying this really frustrating dynamic of Felicity wanting to be something and being, honestly, much more well-prepared for it than, like, male counterparts, but being barred from it specifically because of who she is.
Yeah, which was interesting in, like, conjunction with the fact that she seems to be taking charge for most of the trip, like, Monty can't do anything because he's an idiot.
He's
like,
so useless.
And then Percy is just like there's so many things he can't do because of the color of his skin, and he can't be in charge and like talking to these white people and telling them what to do. And Felicity's like, fuck you guys, I'll be in charge. Like, we'll get some shit done.
Exactly. And along those lines, that reminds me of how many times in this book we see the barriers to access certain like hotels or inns, or the ship that these places were like the barriers to entry are gender and skin color.
Yeah, which I forgot. I think that women were often like not allowed on ships, and so they had to find a ship that would let them on there. But I don't think I realized that like women weren't allowed in hotels. Like, what? How does that make any sense?
Well, I imagine they were, but they had to be prostitutes. Like, that's probably allowed.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
Sex work, I'm sure, was fine. But it's interesting how, like, that's, like, then those sex workers are excluded from the category of woman, or they're, like, an exception to it.
Right.
Or because they're there specifically for men's pleasure, then they're allowed. But if a woman is just traveling around trying to do her own thing, she can't stay in certain places. I don't understand.
I wonder if this changed with time. As the author points out that, like, women would start going on these, like, grand tours of Europe. I wonder if more and more places would let women come and be. I wonder if they had, like, a man with them to take care of them, or if they had other women, like a.
I'm sure they had chaperones, probably, yeah. Like, an elderly aunt or something like that.
A spinster. Mm. That's what seems like a great way to live your life. You're just traveling around taking girls around Europe. Sounds fun.
It's like a study abroad. I know. But like a super bougie study abroad.
I would do that if I was able, I guess. I wouldn't have been in this time because I'm both a woman and black. They would have lost their fucking minds.
Yeah, that's like 3 strikes, not even just 2.
All the strikes. On page 264, Felicity says, ladies haven't the luxury of being squeamish about blood. And I, like, literally laughed out loud as someone, I'm not squeamish about blood, but as a woman who has a period, I was like, yeah, how are women squeamish about blood? Like, that seems like weird to me. But I've also met people who are, and I felt this was a little transphobic.
I think it could be. I don't think she said it in like the, no. No, yeah, it's definitely transphobic if it's like not just people who menstruate or people who have periods, because not everyone who has a period is a woman. And it's like there are people who don't have periods who are also women.
But I like that we're like in a book and talking about the fact that we have periods. And I'm like, yeah, we do. Some of us.
It was funny. It was a pretty good. She was adding her brother pretty hard. Oh, and it was hilarious.
Yeah, like I'm also like, hey, Monty, like, what is wrong with you? Like, why are you fainting at this? He's like, someone get me a fainting couch. And I was like, dude, get it together.
I think everyone except Felicity fainted.
Yeah, I think so. Even Percy, she said, was like pale and like had to sit down.
Which might be coupled with his epilepsy. We don't know. But okay, it also gave, there was the suggestion that it was just because, oh, I'm feeling faint. My delicate disposition.
Which I guess is kind of nice because we see like these very, I guess if you want to talk about like these delicate men.
Absolutely. It definitely changes. These performances of masculinity are different, very different than what we're used to. Like men wear high heels. They're wearing all sorts of like fancy clothes. They're taking hours to get dressed. They're like doing their hair. They have long hair.
They're fainting at the sight of blood.
They need smelling salts.
Oh my God. I was like, what? I don't think I was ready. Like, I didn't expect that, but I was like, oh, this is cool to see these like other kinds of men than like super masculine. I will take care of you.
Blech. That's really interesting that you bring that up, because I think a lot of these period pieces, as in like time period, not like period.
Yeah.
These period pieces focus on women being that way, like movies or books, whichever, historical fiction in general. And instead of focusing on this masculinity that's performed at the time was actually, by modern standards, very quote-unquote feminized.
Yes. Yeah, we don't get that very often. Even sometimes in books written at the time, like when I think of Jane Austen, who I love, don't at me.
She's about 100 years after this.
Okay. But like we see like more masculine, like Mr. Darcy is not like a feminine man.
Or maybe he did have all this stuff and we just don't see it in like all these like grooming habits that would typically be associated with women, but you just don't see it.
Probably because you're not allowed to write it in books. Like people don't bathe or like go to the bathroom or like have periods.
No, fourth wall or whatever wall that is. I don't know.
I think it's a fourth wall, right?
I don't know. It's a theater term that I don't think applies here, but also kind of applies.
Yeah, because we're just like pretending these things don't exist.
We have to talk about illness because that's a big part of the book.
It's a huge part of the book. It was frustrating to see the way that Percy was treating for being sick. He's going to be sent away due to his illness to an asylum. And then Monty's walking on eggshells around him when he found out that Percy was sick.
Oh, that was the worst part for me. I'm like, you're making this all about you, motherfucker.
Which is honestly what people do.
Yes.
Like they don't know how to deal with it. And then I was a little mad when Percy decided that having epilepsy was something he would continue to live with even after Helena offered Percy his mother's heart. And sometimes I think literature puts so much emphasis on the fact that we should love and accept ourselves for who we are that it disregards the fact that some of us would get rid of our illness if we could. I say this as a person with chronic illness. Our illness doesn't define us, but oftentimes literature like makes this point that like, it's part of who we are. We'd be so different without it. Like, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, of course we would. But like, that doesn't mean we have to want to live with it. It was frustrating for me.
It's such a personal decision, I would say.
Yeah. And I get that Percy like needs to come to, like he's coming to terms with the fact that he has epilepsy and it's something he's going to live with forever. As like every person with a chronic illness has to learn. But then he's like, nah, I'm just going to keep it. This heart's going to go to waste. I don't know how I feel about it. It was like, it's still like rumbling around in my mind. Like, I don't know how I feel about him deciding to be like, yeah, I'm going to be epileptic forever.
especially in the 1720s when people like literally thought you were possessed by the devil. I mean, not so much in like, that was more 1500s, 1600s, but.
Well, his family is like having like a priest come to like perform an exorcism, or they're like, he's masturbating too much. And that's why he has epilepsy, forcing him to become a vegetarian, like all these weird things. I was just like, me personally, with my illness, which I feel is not as bad as epilepsy, like I would have been like, yeah, give me that heart. I will eat it Khaleesi style. Like, I'm ready to be done with this.
I can see it in my mind's eye right now.
Well, it would be so gross. I'd probably vom, honestly. Would you take it?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I guess I would also say that my chronic illness isn't as bad as, you know, certain type, like epilepsy,
yeah,
or other chronic illnesses.
Lots of other ones. It's manageable.
It is.
Mostly. Usually.
Usually. I would probably take it if it's just going to get thrown into the fire. And the woman's daughter is offering it to me.
I would have taken it.
And even on the off chance, even if it didn't work, like you don't know until you try, I guess.
Yeah.
Until you try alchemical heart, you don't know if it's going to work for you.
Which seems like a weird thing. But if someone was like, we can cure your disease, take this pill, I'd be like, all right, I'll give it a shot.
I mean, placebo is a thing.
It is a thing.
I mean, I don't know if that works for epilepsy or for the illnesses we have.
No, I doubt it. Yeah, it's kind of hard. I don't know. I would have taken it.
I want to come back to this one particular part of Percy's experience that resonated with me, and it sounds like it resonated with you too. As a chronically ill person, I have also felt the pull to pretend that I'm not as sick or that I'm feeling better than I really am, simply to comfort those around me. Have you done this?
Oh, all the time. Or in the opposite, sometimes the problem is that because it's an invisible illness, having to be like over-explaining that I really am sick when I'm like, I can't come into work, I'm not feeling well. But like I come in the next day and they're like, you seem fine. And I'm like, well, that's because my illness isn't what you think it is. Like, you don't know what's wrong with me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I appreciate how this book demonstrates how the desires of people with the chronic illness often get overshadowed by the people closest to them because they want the person to be better, like cured.
Right.
And do these people just want the person that they care about to be better, or is like their own skin in the game, which it is. Like they just want their lives to be easier because then they wouldn't have to deal with chronic illness.
And right.
Like, okay. Taking care of or being around someone with chronic illness or a person that you love with chronic illness doesn't like ruin your life in any way, shape, or form. And this is what we see Monty owning up to. The fact that he wants a cure-all because then it makes his own life easier.
Right. Yeah.
And all of these conversations are happening in the field of disability studies, and I highly recommend Eli Clare's book, Brilliant Imperfection. Here's the book description. In Brilliant Imperfection, Eli Clare uses memoir history and critical analysis to explore cure, the deeply held belief that body minds, considered broken, need to be fixed. Cure serves many purposes. It saves lives, manipulates lives, and prioritizes some lives over others. It provides comfort, makes profits, justifies violence, and promises resolution to body mind loss. Clare grapples with this knot of contradictions, maintaining that neither an anti-cure politics nor a pro-cure worldview can account for the messy, complex relationships we have with our body minds. This idea of cure, I think, really resonates with this book in particular, mm-hmm. right? That's exactly what's at stake at the core of this narrative. And it's not an easy answer.
And it's also difficult, too, because I've studied a lot of sign language, and something that there's like big D, little d deaf, and some people don't view being deaf as a disability. So there are some things that people they're like, I don't want a cure for that. So there's some people who like some deaf people who are big D deaf that would be like, no, I don't want that cure. Like being deaf is who I am. And some people who would see it like this is a disability, and big D deaf people don't see it that way. So I do think it's difficult in that like what I want for me is going to be different than what someone else wants for them when you're thinking about like a cure for something, because some people might see something that they have as not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So and that's fine too.
Exactly. And even people with the same condition who form part of the same community maybe not don't want the same things.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Because different deaf people even want, like, some of them are getting cochlear implants so they can hear again. And some people are like, no, I would never do that. I would, like, not want that for me or for someone else. Like, I think it's a terrible thing. So, like, even people in the same community with the same, I don't want to say disability, because, like, obviously some people don't think it's a disability, but with the same, like, thing, some of them aren't going to want to cure because they don't think it's something that needs to be cured.
Exactly. And I also think that that is a contradiction, or like a moving target in a single person,
right,
is allowed to change.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, my relationship to my illness is going to change throughout time.
Right. And probably, like, the longer you have it, it's going to feel different. And, like, especially I think for us, because our symptoms can, like, come and go sometimes, like, that also defines how I feel about having my illness. And that can be difficult too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, 10 years in and I'm like, all right, give me that cure. I'm done.
Did you wonder about Monty being an alcoholic?
It's actually something I wrote down. It was like, Monty is an alcoholic. We almost see him maybe going through, like, withdrawal, and he's like counting the days since he last had alcohol.
In his exposition, he talks a lot about this longing or this need for a drink,
right,
or wanting something, wishing there was something stronger than wine when they're in the ship. And I think that he is, like, living with alcoholism and struggling, right, with alcoholism. And I say that with absolutely no judgment, because I'd probably do the same thing if I were in his position.
He's coping.
Exactly.
It's a coping mechanism.
Exactly. And I really like how Mackenzie Lee with this novel is giving visibility to how vulnerable people with non-normative identities are to substance abuse because of their constant struggles with prejudice and discrimination. Trying to escape makes sense.
Yes, it does.
Like, it's a logical reaction. It's not healthy, but it makes absolute sense.
Right. And not only is he, like, he's queer, so he's, like, dealing with all of that, but he's also dealing with, like, this childhood trauma and, like, an abusive emotionally and physically parent. And yeah, I can, like, you're trying to, like, do anything you can to, like, not feel those feelings, which is difficult, but I'm like, you probably don't have therapy then, or your therapy leads to them, like, to lobotomies, so probably wouldn't go,
or an asylum forever.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, what are you gonna do? You're gonna cope the best way you know how, and that's understandable.
Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own.
Bisexual characters, gay characters, ace characters, so much representation, and it's not just side characters this time.
Yay! I was so happy about this.
Me too.
Especially because that was, like, our main beef, or one of my main beefs with the... with some of the novels that we've been reading.
Right. And some future novels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, why is it always the side characters?
And I really liked how the author treated these sexualities as totally okay.
Right.
Like, through the authorial voice, mm-hmm, right? Even though they were existing and positioned within this fictional world filled with prejudice and discrimination, misunderstanding, and oppressive heteronormativity, also oppressive racism. But I you felt that the authorial voice really valued these sorts of, and was, like, validating these identities.
Well, I think she did a good job doing that by, like, showing us what some of the, like, specific people we would see, like, with prejudice, like, Monty's father, and even Felicity saying something about, like, how it's unnatural, like, what Monty's doing, but, like, loving him anyways. Now it's hard because I want to be like, Felicity, you need to, like, turn this around, like, what they're doing is not wrong, even though your religion tells you it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's not cool. But I do like that she is like, I understand that you guys are going to do this, and I, like, still love you. I appreciated that, even though I'm kind of like, it's not good enough, but it's a step forward.
Right. And I think the book also is starting to explore these, like, the legality and the illegality of non-heterosexual people. And what it gets to is, like, the act of, right, sodomy was, right, specifically illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, illegal in the United States in several states until, like, the 70s or something. I have to look it up and put it in the show notes.
But yeah,
it's, like, fucking bullshit. And so, like, how affection isn't necessarily policed.
Right.
I like that we see two men being so intimate with one another and in like before they become romantically involved. That sort of intimacy, I don't think, is afforded as much anymore, or it's not as visible anymore.
Oh, definitely not.
But I really, I think that that was interesting that the book was looking at that tension between the emotions and the like actual physical sexual acts, which were illegal.
Right. But also like a good way to like look at how like just because something is a law doesn't mean that it's like morally good. There are tons of laws, slavery, like anti like everything, you know, like that are saying like these things are bad. And it's like, well, no, just because it's a law doesn't mean it's morally wrong.
Right.
Like
legality and morality aren't on the same side a lot of the time.
Yeah. They're not equal. Even though, like, I think our justice system tries to treat them as if they are. And I'm just like, no, that's bullshit.
It's totally, that's a fiction.
Yeah. No, yeah, of course.
Meant to hold up the justice system as the legitimacy of the justice system.
Yeah. And sometimes in the United States, meant to hold up Christianity, which I'm like, that's bullshit. Like, not everyone's part of that. So, like, fuck off. I'm not here for it.
I really liked the portrayal and celebration of a bisexual character in Monty, and it just seems so natural. He's like, yeah, I have sex with girls and I have sex with guys and I like them both. And he's like particularly in love with Percy, right?
Right.
But it just was, he's like, yeah, this is me.
Right. And I don't think we've had books with other bisexual characters as the main character, not yet at least. And so I was like really glad to like see that. I haven't read any, I don't think I've read any other books with bisexual characters.
I don't think I have either.
I really liked it. And I do think, especially in today's time, we often have like representations of bisexuality in women, but not often in men. So I thought that was like a good way to, I don't know, a different way to go.
And bi erasure is absolutely like a real thing. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you that it, at least recently, I've seen more narratives with bisexual women than bisexual men.
I think it's like seen as more acceptable form of bisexuality for some reason. I don't know why, but it's not more acceptable or less acceptable. They're all acceptable. Mm-hmm.
And even though Monty seems like he's so, or at least in the exposition is so open about it. And it seems like with the people he's close to is open about his bisexuality. We really do see him struggling to accept himself, particularly because of his father's constant emotional and physical abuse.
Right.
So it just gets to the heart of the fact that you can be acting certain ways and having certain feelings, but that doesn't necessarily mean you accept yourself and value yourself.
Yeah. Which was really sad. Like I'm glad in the end that Monty like wrote this letter to his dad as like kind of like a fuck you. Like you're doing shitty stuff. What I'm doing's not shitty. Like I'm out. I was really proud of him.
And it does really, it does seem like everyone else just thinks Monty's gay. That the only person who really realizes he's bisexual is like the reader.
Right.
And also Monty. And probably also Percy.
Maybe Felicity knows. I don't know.
But the like acceptance of bisexuality as an identity, I don't think is happening particularly in this time period with this character, with these characters. But as readers from the 21st century, I'm seeing that.
Yeah. I liked it. There's this quote from Monty on page 497, and it says, "We are not broken things, neither of us. We are cracked pottery mended with lacquer and flakes of gold, whole as we are, complete unto each other, complete and worthy and so very loved." And this, like, okay, I didn't cry because, as you know, I, like, don't cry at anything, but it, like, really got to me, and I was just like, I really love this, and, like, I'm so glad that, like, by the end of the story, Monty realized like he is a person worthy of being loved and maybe even loving himself, even though he's like gone through all these terrible traumatic events. I would have cried if I were someone else.
If you were me?
If I was you.
I agree. I also marked this quote when I was reading. I adore it. And it really reminds me of one of the central points in Hannah Gadsby's Nanette and that Netflix special that if you haven't watched it, go do it. Go do that post haste. I'm looking straight at Jesse.
I know it's on my list of things to do.
It's just the sort of like yielding, not breaking.
Right.
Like these things don't make you broken. They make you, I mean, you had to bend and yield and do things differently in order to survive, but that doesn't mean that you're broken.
Yeah, I loved it.
Sexy times. There were some pretty steamy makeout scenes in the novel. like more detailed
right
than in the, and I think I was like missing that because the last novel that we read, I was like, what?
Too many fade outs.
So many fade outs. And at least like these weren't fade outs. They were like specifically in the narrative. Cannon fire interrupted right. them or something like that.
So many interruptions. So I'm like, many. When are we gonna get to it? And I'm like, it's fine, I guess.
And I just want to make one thing clear, that I appreciate that the author didn't shy away from physiology because she actually mentions erections.
So proud. So good.
They happen, even though most YA makeout scenes would make you think that they magically don't happen.
Yeah, which makes no sense if you've made out with a man.
Or a person with a penis in general. I just thought that was very realistic. Appreciated it.
Yeah. And just like, I don't know, like, upped the ante a little bit on, because like we don't have like there's no sex in the book, and so it just like ups the ante a little bit on the makeout scenes, which I'm usually like, meh, fine. These were like better
because I think there's this tendency a lot of times in YA to romanticize the kissing and the like physicality and the making out,
right?
Like, no, this is also like a sexual thing,
right,
for those characters,
right,
at the same, right, it's not necessarily for everyone, right, mm-hmm. But for the characters in the novels that we've been reading for the podcast, you're like, no, that's like going on,
right, except in the case of Felicity, who's like, no thank you, I'd rather not.
Exactly. Where she's specifically using her feminine wiles to get information,
and I respect that. Mm. You do you, Felicity.
Yeah, that's right, you use the skills at your disposal.
Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in a segment called Kill Your Darlings. I really appreciated the history lesson that took the place of the author's note at the end. It answered some questions I had while reading. There were a couple things I wrote down. I was like, oh, I need to look these things up. Like, I don't know how Black people were treated in England at that time. And I found it really helpful. Thanks for not making me look things up, or as many things.
Yeah, the Mackenzie Lee mentions race relations, the actual tour sort of thing. She mentions
the lives of queer people at that time.
Yes.
It was great.
And did I say epilepsy?
No, you didn't. But yeah, she really like talked about, because I don't know how epilepsy was treated then versus now. I think I kind of assumed that the depictions we got in the book were pretty realistic because, I don't know, because people don't know what's going on at the time.
And they, of course, they would be, like, scared of the unknown.
Yeah, I get it, I guess. But, yeah, I really appreciated that. I'm sure Ravenclaw Kelly appreciated it even more.
I was so happy to see that at the end.
You had to go to no rabbit holes.
Oh my gosh, there are no rabbit holes this episode. Do I need to make one up and add it afterwards? Maybe in the show notes.
In the show notes. Rabbit hole show notes.
Maybe. I loved this part. It was transparent, I think, about the research process.
Right.
And I really liked that. I mean, I imagine you as a Gryffindor librarian Hermione type appreciated the citation of sources and the further reading recommendations.
I don't think I'll read any of those books, but I'm glad that they're there for people who might want to.
I loved the writing style in this book. From the first paragraph, I was like, oh, I'm hooked. I'm in. I don't know how it wasn't like a particularly exciting first chapter or anything, but just something about the voice and how like we just get so intimate with Monty, with the protagonist from the very beginning. And you just have access to, he's just funny and irreverent and like annoying and
yes,
all of these things at once, and it just, you're like, oh, I want you to be my friend.
Yeah, I mean, I might not want to hang out with you all the time because you're also kind of annoying, but like
only when you want to party.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it took me like a second to get into it because it felt like old-timey, like the talking and like the exposition, but it like really puts you into that time period really well because they're like calling each other darling and like saying all these, I don't know, for some reason it took me a second, but I was like, yeah, this feels like it could be written by a person who was alive at that time.
But at the same time, I don't know if you noticed, but I think Mackenzie Lee puts in like specifically 21st century references in the book, like,
for sure.
At the beginning, Monty's like, I woke up like this.
Yeah I saw those and I was just like, and they made me laugh because I'm like, it's so anachronistic, but also like bringing the reader in so they don't feel like too outside of the time period.
Yeah, I loved the mix of like the super contemporary and but like making it, not trying to pretend to write a Jane Austen novel or to pretend to write a novel that was written in the 1720s.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very much a novel written in the 21st century, but adopting a persona and just like manipulating that sort of character to fit a more 21st century like voice. I loved it.
I'm excited to read Felicity's story, like the next book, because I want to like get inside her head a little bit and like find out more about her. And it's good that she like made me wonder those things. Plus like ace characters. Cool.
Recommend if you like
super action-packed travel stories. You know I don't like travel stories, but I was like, this is my shit right here. Like, it, like just so much stuff going on. Like, there was like never a boring moment, and I just like loved that so much.
And so much representation.
Yes. Oh my gosh, all the representation. I felt represented. That doesn't happen to me. I loved it.
I always feel represented, so.
Yeah, well.
I'm a white woman, though, so that's why.
Yeah.
And especially in YA, it's all about white women.
Yeah. So apparently I do like travel stories. There just needs to be something happening in them.
They just need to be action-packed.
Action-packed.
Real talk, Jesse. What did this book make you think about or change your perspective about?
As far as books we've read, this was not particularly violent, but the depictions of abuse in this story really got to me. After seeing the content warning in Girls of Paper and Fire, I wish more books would do that because I wasn't mentally prepared for the parental, like the child abuse in this book at all. And like I said before, like it made me anxious, like reading those parts. And I think because I didn't know it was going to happen, I kind of just, I don't think I would normally ask for that in a book, but this was like the first time that I was like, oh, I wish this had told me that this was going to be something we were dealing with in this book.
You make a really good point. I agree about the content warnings. I think that more books should have them. Absolutely. Girls of Paper and Fire by Natasha Nyan was a good, sets a good standard for that.
Yeah. And I know that book is newer than this book.
Right.
Because this book's from 2017. I thought it was older for some reason. I was like, this book is like 5 years old. It
like,
was not.
You're like, this book's been my TBR for a million years. I know.
It hasn't. It's been like 2 years. But yeah, I was just like, I wish more books would like be more upfront about those things. What about you?
This book really makes me want to read even more stories about LGBTQIA plus people. That's my main thing. I just enjoyed it so much, especially the representation of bisexuality.
Yeah, I agree. We need more of them. We need suggestions, more suggestions. If anyone has any suggestions, we'd love to have them. There are also some on our TBR, so we're getting to them.
Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of A Blade So Black by L.L. McKinney. And watch out for the occasional minisode about a range of fantasy-adjacent topics. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post your tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. If you have an idea for a book that we should add to our miles-long TBR list, please email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on the podcast app of your choice. And if you're feeling benevolent, we'd really appreciate it if you would rate and review the show. JK It's Magic is recorded on lands traditionally belonging to Cheyenne, Ute, and Arapaho Native people. See you in a fortnight. Because just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representation of race, class, and gender, and ability... Damn it.
I added that in there, actually.
I know. This is what I get for not reading the show notes before we start. Okay. You're going to have so many good bloopers.
It's going to be so good. It's going to be hard to choose.